This episode is sponsored by Transcend, a veteran-owned and operated performance optimization company that I introduced recently as a sponsor on this show. Well, since then, I have actually been using my products and I've had incredible success. There was initial blood work that was extremely detailed, and based on that, they offered supplementation. So I began taking DHEA, BPC-157 for inflammation, based on the fact that I've been a stuntman, a martial artist, and a firefighter my whole life, lots of aches and pains, Dihexa to help cognition after multiple punches to the head and shift work, and peptides. 4 months later, they did a detailed blood work again, and I was actually able to taper off two of the peptides because my body had responded so well to just one of them that it was optimized at that point. So I cannot speak highly enough of the immense range of supplementation that they offer, whether it's male health, female health, peptides to boost your own testosterone, which I would argue is needed by a lot of the fire service, or whether it's exogenous testosterone needed, especially after TBIs or advanced age. Now, as I mentioned before, the other side of this company is an altruistic arm called the Transcend Foundation, which is putting veterans and first responders through some of their protocols free of charge. Now, Transcend are also offering you, the audience, 10% off their protocols. And you can find that on jamesgearing.com under the products tab. And if you want to hear more about Transcend and their story, listen to episode 808 with the founder, Ernie Colling. Or go to transcendcompany.com. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show sports nutritionist, Dr. Nathan Jenkins. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from his journey into the world of exercise physiology, studying disease as a vascular cell biologist, obesity, diabetes, the importance of a comprehensive blood panel, gut biome, supplementation, rapid health optimization, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. Now, one more quick side note. My account got shut down for the second time in a year on Instagram for posting kindness, compassion, and community. They don't give a reason. I have no idea what happened, but here we are again, starting at zero. So if you are following this podcast on Instagram, it is now at behindtheshield911.3.0. So with that being said, I welcome onto the show Dr. Nathan Jenkins. Enjoy. Well, Nathan, I want to start by saying two things. Firstly, thank you to our mutual friend, Phil White, for connecting us. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I want to welcome you onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you this afternoon?
You're finding me in a little town called Watkinsville, Georgia. It is almost none of your listeners will know about that unless they're randomly local. But it's just outside of Athens, Georgia, which may be more familiar, is where the University of Georgia is. We are about roughly an hour and a half east of Atlanta.
Beautiful. Well, I would love to start at the very beginning of your timeline. Mm-hmm. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Going way back to the beginning.
Way back.
I was born in the Atlanta area, suburbs of North Atlanta, Marietta, Georgia, where I mostly grew up. Let's see, what's the interesting stuff? So I have a one younger sister. I have sister who stepsister who's the same age as my younger sister. They're about 6 weeks apart, and they're about 2 years younger than me, so we were all really close growing up. And we also have an older stepbrother, 3 years older than me. And that nuclear family all came together when my mom and stepdad got married when I was nine. This is all in the, or was I eight, somewhere in there. We're in ancient history right now, so I might get a little of the details mixed up. But let's see, what can I tell you? That was, these are fun times. So we moved from the Atlanta area out to Seattle, Washington, right pretty much immediately when my mom's stepdad got married. His job took us out there, and we thought we were going to be there for forever. We were only there for about 2 years before his job then brought us back to the Atlanta area. And so all that to say, and then I've more or less lived in somewhere in the state of Georgia pretty much ever since, minus a few years of my graduate training and postdoctoral work, which we can talk about. But to answer the first part of the question about family dynamics and growing up, I can share that we were all, you know, very active in sports, very, you know, physical activity and exercise, which is now a big part of my life. That was a big thing for us. But then I also, interestingly, it's at the same time that was true, I also struggled with my body weight as a child. The Jenkins side of my family, so my dad's side in particular, very traditional Southern upbringing, lots of great Southern food. And this is the 80s and 90s that we're talking about, when we're past the initiation of the overweight and obesity epidemic, but in the exponential growth phase of that. And so I definitely got caught up in that. And so living, and also my a major impact for me is my my grandfather, my dad's dad, died young of, well, it was mainly from complications of smoking, but he had heart disease. I think he survived at least one or two heart attacks before the last one he did not. And then he also had lung cancer and all that from smoking. And so that's not a happy thing to share, but it was, I remember being very young, being, you know, of course, sad about all that. I was close with my grandpa, but that sparked an interest in health and fitness at a pretty early age, and in physiology, in particular cardiovascular physiology, which is what I ended up focusing on primarily. In my, my graduate school days, and as an exercise physiologist eventually. So, there's a lot I could share about the childhood years, but we can keep going.
No, well, I mean, this is what's interesting, because normally what people experience in the younger years, they really do factor into choices and passions as they get older. When you reflect back now, what was the kind of nutrition that you were served in school?
Oh, in school, it was, it's processed on processed foods, which I'm not a complete anti-processed food zealot by any means, but that was, you know, very calorie dense, but nutritionally poor food for sure. And listen, I grew up in a at least middle class, and then later on, very upper middle class, frankly, affluent area. And it didn't matter, the quality of the food was, it was not great. It was not great. So, but we had good food at home for sure. You know, mostly whole foods. A lot of my mom and my dad both cooked quite a bit of food at home. My stepdad's a lousy cook, but he did a bunch of other good stuff, but that was not one of them. But, you know, always grew up eating, you know, for the most part, very healthy food. So, the school is disaster.
I just learned recently from one of the guests that currently, at least, the food that's served in our schools and prisons, there's two parallel and similar paths, are technically expired foods that these processed food companies sell for a lesser price to those. So not only are our children getting shit food, but they're getting expired shit food, which is even worse.
Yeah, that I didn't know that. That's today. Wow, that sounds like a stat from the era that we're talking about, the 80s and 90s. if that's a 2025 statistic, that's concerning.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned about being active. What were the sports and exercise that you were playing and doing back then?
Well, as a kid, mostly one thing my parents were really good about, and I think about this a lot now because I now have a 3-year-old, and so starting to think about sports for him. The mantra was exposure to everything. I played baseball, basketball. I never really played football other than just like yard stuff. But most team sports, I doubt it was for at least a season or two. But the real in my youth, like physical activity, exercise experience wasn't really so much from sports as much as it was. I got very, very into, first it was weight training, and this would be categorized today as like traditional bodybuilding style weight training. Again, we're talking like 1998, 1999, 16 years old. I got a membership with the local Globo gym with mirrors and free weights. And I was that kid, the high school kid doing curls in front of the mirror. And I loved it. I absolutely fell in love with that. And then around the same time, maybe a couple of years, but still in high school, I got into mountain biking. A buddy of mine in the neighborhood had a mountain bike and he was really into it. We were good friends. And one time I borrowed his little sister's bike and we went in the mountains of North Georgia, which, okay, depending on where you're located, that may be loosely defined as mountains, but they were mountains to us. And definitely some steep grades. But that's been, with some breaks here and there throughout my life, that's been a lifelong, at least hobby. I raced a little bit in college for a few years. I did a little, so modest competition history there. But those two, man, I couldn't get enough either of weight training or mountain biking. This is in the early days. And that's been more or less, again, a lifelong thing.
What was it that helped you turn the corner from the weight being challenging to the fitness path?
Yeah, let me think about that. It was in early high school. I think I just kind of decided I didn't want to be a pudgy kid anymore. coming out, you know, it's pretty common kind of coming out of like that prepubescent phase where a lot of boys, I know I did, tend to pack on a few extra pounds. And I don't remember the exact, if there was an exact thing. I do remember one kind of thing was my stepbrother, who I mentioned, was, so he was 3 years older than me. He was in high school playing football and in the weight room a lot. And he got very strong and really muscular, really fit. And I wanted to be like him. I wanted to, so I would have been like 12 or 13 when I remember the first time lifted weights in the basement of that house that we lived in. And it was really fun and all that. But what I will never forget was just the extreme soreness that persisted. Like the next day, it was just shocking. And then the 2 days later, it was even worse. And it was probably 4 weeks before, four days before I felt somewhat normal again. And I, from what I understood, and this was internet existed, but it wasn't like I could go on and look up delayed onset muscle soreness and learn about it. But it was just the way that I think my stepbrother, my stepdad, the way they explained it to me, he's like, yeah, that's the, essentially they were right. That means your muscles are going to get stronger. They're damaged. They're going to heal and you're going to get stronger. I was like, that is the coolest thing in the world. Let me do it again. And so, got really into it. And then kind of the nutrition piece, like as I gained muscle, I remember it's like I was gaining muscle. The nutrition piece, fell into place. At that time, it was very well known and very well understood that eating more protein means you gain more muscle. So I became obsessed with like lunch meat. and this is also, again, high school boy, voracious appetite, ate my poor mother out of house and home. She couldn't hardly keep the pantry and the fridge stocked. And I remember one time my younger stepsister she was going into the cupboard looking for a snack. And she was, I can't remember what snack she was looking for, but it was something I had already eaten. She just looks at me, she goes, why do you have to eat everything? So you eat everything in the whole house. So anyway, that was what we're talking about. It's like the nascent days of my, again, a lifelong fascination with nutrition and fitness. So
when you were in high school, were you already thinking of following that educational path, or was there something else in your mind?
In high school, I had no idea. I knew I wanted to go to college, but I had no idea what I wanted to do or study. I think I started, college as a political science major, just because I enjoyed, you know, social studies in high school, government classes and stuff. And that lasted all of about 3 weeks. all it took was the first, you know, political science 101 class to know that, it was, okay, this is fine, but I don't want to study this for all 4 years. At this point, I remember being in the dorm on my gigantic, you know, huge old school PC with the monitor that was like weighed like 4,000 pounds. It's doing a deep dive into the websites of all, I went to University of Georgia, which fortunately for me, that was a large land grant institution with lots of majors available. Like I wasn't at a small liberal arts school with just, you know, relatively smaller selection. So I was just like looking through everything that seemed interesting to me. And I was looking for something in, you know, the fitness or nutrition. I came across exercise science, exercise and sports science. And I was like, that's what I'm trying to read about and learn about all the time anyway. I had no idea even when I started on campus that was an option, that was a major, but I came across it just searching. And so, yeah, that's what I switched to and stayed with it. So
I went and did sports science and fitness evaluation in University of North London. And then just recently, a few years ago, finished off my bachelor's at UF, and that was exercise physiology.
Yeah.
When I reflect back, the problem that I had, in at least my personal experience, was it seemed like it really groomed you to stay in a lab rather than to leave and be, you know, a coach or, you know, some of the more hands-on things where you're able to move the needle on your own performance and then also help people in the gym, on the field. What was your experience educationally as far as the academic side?
It was almost exactly that. It's a really cool major and a cool degree. And there are certainly programs around the country, around the world, that are very effective at training trainers and training fitness professionals. But for the most part, the field is quite academic, and that's cool. But for me, for example, it was, and that's the track that I was on. So it was a good fit for me. I liked the idea of, I knew from when I was a freshman in college that I wanted to be a professional researcher, which was, you know, kind of unusual. But I just happened to have that exposure. I had a fantastic professor who was very open to undergraduates doing research in the lab. And I saw that and I was like, I want this guy's job. All he, you know, what he likes, what he seems to do is walk around and ask people questions all day, you know, students, and invite academic discussion. I loved it. I was all for it. So it was great for that, but to your point, it wasn't ideal for training, you know, learning things that would actually help if you're a personal trainer or a coach, your client or your athlete in the gym on Monday morning necessarily. I don't want to speak in absolutes. There's definitely spaces for that, and every program is going to be different. But you mentioned UF, which is also a very academic institution. And that department in particular is excellent academically, and some of the best research in our field. I'm familiar with some of the vascular physiology that's come out of the UF is absolutely incredible, but it wouldn't be a great fit for at least that particular program, that particular lab or whatever. It wouldn't be a great fit at all for somebody that's trying to dive deeper in the coaching space. So,
yeah, we had one semester where basically it was a prep class for the NSCA CSCS. That was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And it was a hybrid class. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think it was a remote class. Really well done. Mm-hmm. You know, all the content was there. But then, yeah, you go into some of the other ones and it was so myopic that you were like, very okay, myopic. I understand the idea, the concept, but where's the application to your regular athlete?
That's right. That's right. And it became, so I remember I taught now we're going to jump ahead to when I was a professor at UGA for 9 years. I taught a graduate course on exercise metabolism, and it was a required course for our, the students in the master's strength and conditioning specialist. So it was a non-thesis track. It was purely basically for coaches. And I ended up changing. I kept the concepts the same, but when I inherited that course from the faculty member who taught it before me, it was all research. It was all readings. It was all, again, it's purely academic. But after like a semester or two of teaching that course, I was like, I got to change this to make it more applicable to our clientele, basically to the students. And so it became, I mean, it's still very much grounded. Like those students were doing a lot of reading. So I tried to thread the needle as best I could. It was, if you're going to have a master's degree, then yes, you need to be an intelligent and educated and professional consumer of research. So we're going to use our course readings to teach you that skill. But I totally changed I wasn't having people memorize the biochemical pathways anymore, because you're not going to do that for a client. But we will have a good understanding of the energy systems, the metabolic energy systems that tend to govern exercise, different types of exercise performance. And then, and they did a lot of really cool, I'm just remembering now, it's been a while, but they did a lot of really cool group projects on, they would pick an athlete or a particular sport and do like a case study and identify like, one thing that I did was pretty cool. Was like, I want you to identify the third or fourth place finisher in this Olympic sport. Talk to me about like, why aren't they the first place? Is it, can you come up with a physiological reason why they're, maybe not the top person? It created a lot of discussion, but so anyway, sorry, tangent, rabbit hole. This is a challenge for the universities, where yes, the people like yourself, who want to level up their game with their education, their credentials, you go look in the ivory tower, and you're not going to find a lot of applicable stuff, even if you do get the nice letters behind your name and all that.
I think this is why we're seeing, I just saw an article recently, a lot of the Gen Z generation are going into the trades. And I think the reason is you can look online, and for the same reason that a lot of people aren't going to the fire service at the moment, you can now research all the bad side, all the, the diseases and the mental health things. When they look at your average degree, they say, okay, it's tens of thousands of dollars and you get a piece of paper and it doesn't guarantee you a job, versus the trades. Obviously, it's a more intense version of education. And then, you've got the skill set, and you leave. And I think that maybe is the future of higher academia as well, is to start bringing back some of that, hands-on real world elements, so that if someone is going to be in an academic facility for 2 or 4 years, that when they step out the back door, that they do have a track to an actual profession.
Absolutely. And I'm all for higher education when it makes sense. As talking to somebody with a doctorate degree, was a professor for a long time. But I'm thinking about my son when who knows what the landscape's going to be like in about, call it 15 years or so when he's making that decision. But I'm not necessarily an advocate for everybody to go to college anymore. And, if you ask me that probably 10 years ago, maybe 15, 20 years ago when I was in it, like for sure, that's what everybody needs to do, but completely not the case now. Even by the time students would get to me, so in the undergraduate program, they were in their junior or senior year. I remember thinking, wow, this college may not have been for this person. They really need to be, a trade might be a better fit. And that might've been smarter for them, So it's an interesting challenge for sure.
No, 100%. While we're on the subject of still in college, and obviously I'm sure you're interacting with a lot of athletes during that time, one of the observations, and I talk about this all the time on here, but I think it's an important topic to bring up. When I first moved to America, after a while, I kept bumping into what I call Uncle Ricos. So these guys were either side of 30-ish, very deconditioned by this point, and every single one of them had a story as I would have been in the NFL, NHL, NBA, had it not been for my insert horrendous career-ending injury here. And I remember thinking, what are they doing to children in this country? And then you live here now, my son's 18 and my stepson is 24. So, been more exposed to it now. But I realized that in the UK, at least when I was young, and obviously now you can tell by my face, that was a long time ago. You know, we didn't play sports at a super high level. We didn't do a lot of strength conditioning and training. We just played. And then, you know, by osmosis, the kids that were really good, they would find themselves in, you know, the training teams that sent you to Manchester United or whatever your sport was. But everyone else played sport a lot. But then when you graduated school, you saw people keep playing sport, you know, local leagues and pub leagues and all that kind of thing. Yeah. As I was more exposed to athletics in America, what I realized is that a high, high level of performance was squeezed out of these high school and college kids at the detriment of their wellness and longevity. What 100%. Is your perspective of that now with this pretty, you know, interesting veteran lens that you have?
Oh, well, I wouldn't say that. I'm going to answer your question, but with the caveat that we're not in my real area of expertise at all. But I think my opinion, my sense is that there's an over-specialization in sport. And culturally, I should say overemphasis on this idea that kids need to specialize in a sport at a young age. And like you said, try to peak for performance in high school. And I think there's a lot of negative consequences to that. One of which is the propensity for injury, the increased injury risk that comes with it that you're talking about, which that can come from many things, that either overuse injury in a particular set of movement patterns for a particular sport or a particular position in a sport. Or when they, on the off chance that you say you're a baseball player and then you're playing a game of football in the yard and you're not used to twisting and turning and doing all those dynamic things, then that's when you snap your ACL or whatever. Well, that's because it's a novel movement, right? And there's lack of physical preparation for that kind of demand. The other negative side effect that I think you also touched on is that, you know, we don't, after we, I give my friends a hard time about this all the time. It's like, yeah, athletically, this is my neighbors next door or whatever. You peaked in high school. You know, this whole phenomenon of peaking in high school, or maybe even in college, and then kind of hanging it up and not really continuing to participate in physical activity in a more general sense. Well, that's one of the biggest reasons for, physical inactivity and quote unquote age-related declines in health and physiological performance. And so, you know, culturally, that begins, I think, with what we're talking about, which is the, there's multiple reasons for the lack of physical activity, lack of health-related behaviors, but I think there's a certain subset of our culture, a significant group of folks where this, what we're talking about is applicable. My own father is another example. He was an athletic man growing up and played football, played all sorts of sports, a very strong man. But then after high school, he didn't do much at all. And that's another reason for how I am the way I am. Pendulum swings one way and then sometimes goes the other way with generations. And so, I think it's, I hope that answers your question. I think it's a significant thing.
Yeah, no, it does. And I think this is a powerful conversation, is if the way that we're, you know, again, squeezing that performance at the detriment of the student, then we're not only setting them up for success setting them up for failure with the injuries, you've got also the psychological burnout. But then, because you've driven them so hard, you've really just kind of squeezed the love of sport, the love of play out of them as well. Mm-hmm. And so you look at some of these other healthier, you know, nations around the world where adults are still playing and they're still playful. It's not about winning. It's not about trophying. I feel like we need to kind of circle back round to where the middle ground is, because even listening to the people that do work with incredible athletes, I hear it over and over again. The best athletes are also multi-sport athletes, as you said.
Oh, yeah.
The guy that can play baseball, but also football and soccer and basketball.
100%.
You know, that creates not only a high performer, but a well-rounded athlete that hopefully will carry on playing sport after they graduate.
Yeah. For my son, I want again, exposure to everything, but gosh, there's a few sports that tend to lend themselves well, just observationally, soccer and track and field. Folks who I've seen that I've known over the years that were involved with those, in their youth, there's almost always a physiological and fitness related advantage if they continue with it like later in life. You know, I've never known anybody that was a good runner when they were a kid yes, there's some injury things with running and overuse and all that, but, or like a soccer seems to have, develops an athleticism that can carry forward into many other things, kind of have like a ripple effect. So I say that I didn't start running until I was almost 40, and I've never played soccer. But I call it regrets. I don't know that I wish I had.
Well, it's never too late, because I just started playing with a group. I think it's been 2 years now, and I'm 51. Yeah. So okay. just to pick cool. up league on a Sunday, and it's so much fun.
I'm sure it's awesome. I'm sure it's really fun. So yeah, so definitely going to enroll my son Camden in soccer, like for the 4-year-old league next year. And so I'll try to pick it up with him. let me start with the 4-year-old level and then if I can display competency there, I might gain a little bit of confidence to start playing with some friends.
So going back to the educational side, I know mm-hmm. that you were a vascular cell biologist. Now, talk to me about how that applies in elite performance, but did that also take you down the vascular disease path as well?
Yeah. So how to describe this succinctly? I've probably got that language of vascular cell biologist, also vascular physiologist. So I always had this intense interest in mechanisms by which exercise and nutrition could prevent or potentially reverse various types of cardiovascular disease. That was like my area of study, my area of research. I've also had a longstanding interest in the vascular consequences of metabolic diseases like type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance. And so again, that was the academic stuff. This is in the academic world. I wouldn't say that those areas necessarily parlayed into any kind of like coaching or work that I've done in the industry. Other than, I guess there's a couple. One is, I got into nutrition coaching while I was still a professor. It was kind of like a side gig that became, when my son was born, it escalated to like a full-time job kind of thing. So I had two, I was a professor and a nutrition coach, and I couldn't keep doing both. So I decided to go all in on, nutrition coaching and, resigned from my position at the university. And then it was after several years of doing the nutrition coaching thing that I, recently, the last couple of years, got linked up with my current role at Rapid, which is a biomarker analyst, the labs analyst. And so, to answer your question, finally, I'm kind of like hearkening back, drawing back from a lot of both content and way of thinking from my academic days in translating my main deliverables to our clients, which is basically to interpret various biomarkers from blood, urine, stool, and saliva, and from all these various tests that they do, and identify what are their key physiological constraints, what's going on in their bodies. You know, what can I identify anything from that expansive look under the hood of their body, basically, and maybe correlate with their symptoms, whatever it is that issues they may be having or things that they want to work on. And so that is bringing me back to big component. Like, so we work a bunch of different things, right? But things like lipids, cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, the whole array of all of that, various inflammatory markers, metabolic markers like fasting glucose, HbA1c, insulin levels, etc. That's all all that content, all that stuff is very much in my wheelhouse and in my background. And so it's a really cool opportunity for me to be able to kind of get back into the literature in that way. And then also, instead of teaching in the university classroom, which was awesome, which I love that, and I miss that. I have this belief that coaching and teaching are basically two words that mean the same thing. They're synonyms. And so through my coaching role, I'm actually teaching clients a lot of things about physiology, but in a manner that's helpful for them. So
it's interesting. When I was younger, I think people really believed that you couldn't reverse disease. You know, if you had mm-hmm. diabetes, if you had, you know, vascular disease, then that was it, that you were doomed to be on these pills and just waiting one day mm-hmm. to croak. And then the older I get and the more I'm exposed to, and some of the documentaries like Forks Over Knives, and you start seeing, okay, mm-hmm. wait a second, you know, yeah, if you go back to eating the way that humans were supposed to eat, there is a good chance that you can reverse even some of these cancers. So as you started kind of diving in the research and doing your own, talk to me about that element. You know, how reversible are, obviously not the super acute, but, you know, the mm-hmm. early stages, mid stages of these chronic diseases mm-hmm. that so many people are told in doctor's offices are irreversible.
That's right. I've in my academic career and also, you know, coaching as well, I have lived through a big transition on this, particularly on, type 2 diabetes. When I was in school, I learned that type 2 diabetes was irreversible. And then various medical guidelines and position statements and sort of diabetes related governing bodies for that aspect of the medical community have walked that back and said, you know, within these, there's diagnostic criteria for diabetes, HbA1c above, 6%? Now, okay, now I'm blanking. but is that whatever that the threshold is, reverse. Yes, you can, when you're above that, then it's a positive diagnosis for type 2 diabetes. But then with lifestyle and there's multiple ways to do it, but mainly lifestyle, a good diet, more physical activity, you actually can move the needle and get below that. The diagnostic criteria. So, it's absolutely. Some things are reversible. And there's also like in the setting of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, it's tough to reverse that without pharmacologic therapy, but with significant nutritional intervention or weight loss, you can at the very least have plaque stabilization. And some studies do promote plaque regression. With exercise alone, that's one of the things that we looked at quite a bit. Can you reverse an atherosclerotic plaque? Can you make an atherosclerotic plaque smaller with just exercise? The answer seems like probably not. You can certainly stabilize. One of the mechanisms of the vascular benefits of exercise in that context is that you can help stabilize a plaque. So a plaque can become less prone to rupture with exercise, but you can't really reverse it. But anyway, yeah, certain diseases, that's a big question of mine always is, are these diseases really irreversible? And the answer is no. Some of them are reversible. You can quote unquote cure them. So I think that's really cool.
No, I do too. Another thing that seems to have changed as we've evolved is the conversation from plaque to more like inflammation. So rather than mm-hmm. there actually be just all these fatty clots sort of floating around just waiting to break off, that the lining was actually more inflamed than anything else. Mm-hmm. So what have you seen as far as that kind of metamorphosis of the understanding of the physiology behind heart disease?
Yeah. So there's different types of heart disease and different types of vessel wall pathology. Inflammation is a big component of pretty much all of it. So the conventional thinking of how atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease works is like an ischemic atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease is where the plaque builds up continually, progressively over time, and it gets thicker and thicker and thicker, and the lumen, the diameter of the artery gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and eventually it gets too small and blood can't go through it anymore. Anything downstream of of that artery, of that blood supply, because subject to lack of blood flow and eventually tissue death. And if that's a coronary artery, then that's a big problem, right? And that does happen. I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but there's a lot more to it. To your point, it's not just the narrowing of the artery. It's not just the lack of blood flow in that sense, but it turns out that much more of the prevalence of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease is actually where the lumen diameter doesn't really change that much, but the plaque is building up progressively on that. And there's hypertrophy of the plaque essentially, such that the wall is getting thicker and thicker and thicker. Again, the lumen staying about the same size, but there's this buildup of lipid deposition and nasty things like immune cells, which are in very much inflammatory in nature. When immune cells take up residence in the vessel wall, they kind of create this microenvironment of inflammation. It begets more and more inflammation. It's a feed forward thing. And the dangerous thing about these plaques, and by the way, this is called outward remodeling rather than inward remodeling, which is in the first scenario. Well, the dangerous thing is that these plaques, they can, in stages of advanced inflammation, they can become prone to rupture. And when they rupture, it's a thrombotic event. It's a thrombotic cleavage event where this basically blood clot breaks off and flows downstream. And then that's what actually causes the acute event, where at first it's okay, it can flow through the vessel, but what happens in the arterial tree? Well, as you get further and further branched out, the vessels get smaller and smaller and smaller, and eventually that thrombus will become lodged in an artery or arteriole where it cannot flow anymore, and that's where we get the massive event. And so that understanding, sort of new understanding of the pathophysiology of the outward remodeling and the lumen staying about the same size and the thrombotic event being the main stimulus for the main event for like the heart attack, that was like pretty revolutionary. This occurred probably in the 80s and 90s, but still it's taken a long time for that to become that knowledge to become more mainstream. And it may actually even be new for some of the listeners hearing this. If you're not live in that world, it may not be something that you're necessarily aware of, that more of the, and I'd have to look at the numbers, different studies show different numbers, but the prevalence of ischemic events, like coronary artery events that occur due to plaque rupture and the thrombotic event that I'm talking about, is something like, I don't want to say specific numbers, but it's the vast majority, as opposed to that progressive narrowing of the artery. This is kind of like the biological stuff, but anyway, that's to answer your question, inflammation is a huge part of that. And it turns out what can we do with this information? Well, that's one of the reasons for if blood work shows a significant inflammatory signature, or even something like a gut health analysis, stool analysis shows a significant inflammatory signature. Well, there's a lot of reasons that we want to address that and reduce inflammation and get inflammation something that's managed. And I say to get rid of inflammation altogether, inflammation when dosed appropriately and administered appropriately can be a very powerful adaptive signal. And it's an important part of immunity and of host defense of fighting off foreign pathogens, but we don't want it to be running rampant in your coronary arteries.
You know? Absolutely. I want to get to kind of some of the reasons that we're even here now, as far as a nation's health, sure. But one more area when we're on the diabetes conversation, I've had a lot of people talking about recently is Alzheimer's being termed as type 3 diabetes. So talk to me about the nutritional element of improving the risk for some sort of neurodegenerative disease.
Yeah, so I've heard that for quite a while now. Who is the guy at Emory, not far from me, that actually, I think he coined it. But in any case, it's essentially a problem of excessive glycation and the attendant inflammation in the brain is Alzheimer's. It is very much linked to dysregulation of blood glucose and insulin resistance and all that. So yes, a major mechanism of neurodegenerative disease. And again, another reason to be paying attention to our glucose regulation and our, you know, glucose homeostasis. So.
Absolutely. Well, before we dive into what you are doing now, when mm-hmm. you were doing the research, when we look back at decades prior, what mm-hmm. has changed about nutrition, about, again, because we alluded to play, sports, et cetera, activity of the mm-hmm. general population, and then what has this uptick of obesity actually looked like and diabetes and these other diseases?
Yeah, so that what are the major contributing factors to type 2 diabetes and kind of what's changed? So my sense of what has changed is we've kind of come full circle back to the importance of just maintaining a healthy body composition, number one. There's a lot of debate, and I'm not sure on your podcast what kind of conversations you've had around this, but gosh, there was a period there where there can be a hyperfixation on sugar. And don't get me wrong, sugar, excessive carbohydrate intake as a part of, it can absolutely be a part of, and it almost always is a big part of the development of type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. That being said, it's not the current understanding, a view that I have is that it's not only about sugar, and it's never about any one thing. A big driver for a lot of health related variables is just maintaining a healthy body composition. And a big component of that relates to just fundamentals of energy balance. You know, we get into the really, really basics of like thermodynamics as it applies to the human body. Energy in, if it's an excessive of energy expended, then there will be a net accumulation of body weight. And unless there's a lot of strength training going on, it's probably going to be body fat. And that is the main driver from a physiological standpoint of multiple pathologies. And because of the inflammatory component of excess body fat and the inflammatory component of certain foods that are commonly consumed to create that caloric surplus. Has that changed? None of that has really changed, but the focus on those fundamentals has been kind of like shifting over time. You know, it's, there's been lots of distractions with stuff, both in the research world and certainly in the mainstream, like consumption of it all.
Culturally though, like as far as external influences, what are the factors, school food, fast food, inactivity, et cetera? What are the factors that have changed where in the 50s and 60s, Americans were still very healthy? Fast forward to the 80s, 90s, and where we are to now, you know, today, now we've got 70% of the country is obese and 40% are 70% are overweight and 40% are obese. Mm-hmm. So environmentally, what are the changes that we need to identify and reverse to create an environment for health rather than disease?
Yeah. Yeah. The changing the environment's tough. I think at least on the folks that I work with and talk to, and it's just having an improved awareness of the environment that we're in. We're in that quote unquote obesogenic environment. We're in an environment where there's an abundance of food and an abundance of opportunity to move as little as possible, or that we're discouraged from movement and discouraged from work. And so for me, I have to engineer that stuff into my life rather than just do it out of necessity. So that's something that's changed a lot. And then two, culturally, we already talked about a lot of it. Culturally, we're not really at a societal level funneled into a direction that promotes a lot of physical activity and call it balanced eating or eating in a manner that's consistent with our physiological needs. We're not thinking about a lot of the other big movers like sleep or stress management, those which are also really huge pillars of health as well. As far as how to affect change, the conversations around like societal level stuff, it gets me maybe a little bit anxious and easily depressed because it's hard to think about that. But that's such a big issue. But on an individual level and in the in your small circles of influence, which is what I try to operate in, and that includes, well, what I do for a living, then again, the awareness of our environment and being proactive about engineering those changes into your own life, and it's into that, and that has ripple effects on the family too, right? But so what does that look like? Well, for me, exercise is a non-negotiable. It's the first thing I do when I wake up every morning. And sometimes it's twice a day when I have time. In fact, I worked out this morning at 8:30, and when you and I are done, I'm gonna use the daylight we got left to go knock out some track type interval running workout right here on the street. I would just run up and down my street over and over again for my 400 meter repeats. My neighbors think I'm crazy. It just takes being measured with your nutrition and all of that good stuff. So yeah, and it's at the end of the day, it's an education problem, I think, not so much of like, we know that excess calorie intake is bad. I don't mean education in that sense, but education with the individuals that we work with. Okay, like what are some habits when it comes to education? It's like habit formation and lifestyle change that are actually going to become lasting, right? And become something that we can build a lifestyle around.
I've said this on here many times. What really made me angry was we had no better opportunity to finally turn this around than COVID. You know, here's this this virus that sweeps through. It's, you know, unless you're a complete denier, it's very evident that if you are obese, if you are a smoker, if, you know, you have pre-existing conditions, that you are much, much more likely to die from the virus than if you are a healthy person that's exercising and eating well and getting outside. And we had a captive audience, like for a year plus, where you could have put all kinds of information out there. You could have revisited what we serve in our schools, bolstered PE programs, you know, given incentives to local farmers to create organic food again.
100%.
And none of that was done. So we had the perfect opportunity to make a huge dent, which spanned both political sides of the aisle as well, to be very clear.
Sure.
And nothing was done. So I think this is such a huge disservice, because we have created an environment, as you mentioned, for ill health. It sets you up for failure, unless you had the kind of upbringing like I did, where you grew up on a farm and therefore you had that baseline before you kind of found yourself in modern society. Everyone else, if they've grown up and processed food and, you know, TV dinners and fast food is your norm, and you don't have to do PE anymore, you know, I mean, we've created such a terrible environment that then factors into, you know, military recruitment, first responder recruitment. So there was an opportunity is what I'm saying, and we completely blew it.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. In fact, I strongly agree. And you're reminding me of one of the greater phases of frustration that I had. There were many as a university professor, but it was, I was running a lab with the expressed purpose. It was like in our mission statement on the door of the lab, basically, it was prevention and treatment of chronic diseases. And all the stuff that everybody was dying from during COVID, I had spent my entire career researching, you know, how to stop those things. And the frustrating thing was that when we were kind of doing the return from COVID, the university, and in some ways I understand the abundance of caution here, but they just like would not let our studies proceed because of it's impossible to do an exercise study and be socially distanced. And, you know, capturing spit in a plastic tube in a metabolic lab was not exactly, deemed favorable during the midst of a worldwide pandemic that we had never seen before. But that, like, we had opportunities to make progress there that absolutely were missed for sure.
Just before we go into rapid, you touched on the word sleep, which is my, you know, trigger word, because I come from a profession that's probably the most overworked, underslept population, but also responds to everyone's worst day. It's the most insane, double-edged sword, if you like. Talk to me about your perspective. You mentioned it as far as a pillar of health. As far as sleep and performance, if you study that at all with the athletes, and then sleep and, you know, chronic health, like the longevity piece.
Yeah. It's more the second one that I would say I've worked with the most is sleep and just general health. But can speak a bit to the first on performance, but, it's, it underpins almost everything. So I always, if you think of the three big pillars, sleep, nutrition, and exercise, in my opinion, and I'm an exercise guy, I'm trained as exercise physiologist, I'm all about the fitness stuff, but I would put exercise as a distant third place to the first two. And I can never really pin down which of the, whether sleep or nutrition that are most important, but they're both absolutely critical. I think it depends. I think the answer to that is wherever it is that you have the greatest need is the most important for you. But like for me, my sleep, not because of line of duty or anything, not professionally, but just for lack of, we can't all be perfect, right? my sleep is a disaster. But it's gotten a lot better. It's gotten a lot better in the last 2 years as I've been more aware of it. But before that, it was just something I was like, yeah, I'll sleep when you're dead, kind of like, you know, nose to the grindstone, work hard, that kind of thing. And that's also, I run into that a lot in my with my clients. Oh, goodness, what doesn't it affect? You talked about neurodegenerative diseases. It's one of the major mechanisms for either being susceptible to or resilient against that. Any measure of cognitive function, cognitive performance is going to be affected by sleep. Metabolic health is many of our hormonal pulses throughout the day and throughout the night are governed by or essentially operate on a circadian rhythm type of cycle. And that is completely driven by sleep and awakeness. And so this disturbances in that can have real and profound metabolic effects. So, and regulation of inflammation. So sleeping is one of the if not the most anti-inflammatory physiological states that we're ever in our lives. And so when we lose that, then we create a pro-inflammatory environment essentially. So yeah, it's huge. It's huge.
Absolutely. Which is why I think sadly, you know, it's the elephant in the room or the herd of elephants, as I say, with responders, and we die of everything.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, if you're not sleeping, it's just going to amplify whatever the weakest link is in your chain.
Yeah. And I don't know the solution to that. I mean, and are you talking, particularly people who are on shift work that are, you know, it's something to just kind of be aware of. And I'm not an expert on how to optimize sleep in those, for those individuals, that's a large part of your audience, I understand. The short answer is I'm a big fan of napping when it's, you know, needed, and to just optimize sleep hygiene within your constraints. I mean, whenever you have the opportunity to sleep, take it and maximize it and do all the things that you can do to optimize it for what it is, for sure.
Yeah. Well, but the fire service is scheduled. I mean, they work 56 hours a week, you know, they're understaffed because as I alluded to, people don't want to do this job anymore. So now they're filling in vacancies. Now it's an 8-hour work week. So the way we can make a massive dent is to actually give them the rest and recovery between each shift, you know, the 72 hour period that we need to get as close to baseline as you can, having been awake when everyone else is asleep. But instead we have them working twice as many hours as the person in the grocery store. Yeah. So it's insane. Yeah. So as you mentioned, you were in the academic space for a long time. What made you go into rapid health optimization? And then let's start talking about what you guys offer.
Sure. So what made me link up with Rapid? Well, as I mentioned, I think I mentioned this earlier, I was a professor for quite a long time. And then about halfway through that part of my career, I started nutrition coaching just as a kind of a hobby is how I used to always describe it. I would work with clients. It was all, you know, via email online in the evenings rather than like watch television. When I started coaching, I always tell the story. When I started coaching, I was in the middle of the Game of Thrones, I think season 4 or 5. And then I immediately replaced that time with coaching. And then I've never finished the series. So, and I'm fine for that. I didn't really need to pick that up again. But then that led to so this is the story of the exodus from academia. That job started off with 5 to 10 clients initially, and then eventually around peak post COVID, when there was that greater awareness, I had over 100, and the most I ever had was around 150 clients, which was that was like too many. I started missing emails and making mistakes. Scaled that back a bit, but it still had a you know, call it give or take 100, 120 clients, right around the time my son was born 3 years ago in spring of 2022. And I just couldn't keep that going. Okay. So, went all in on the coaching, and then kind of, over the next couple of years would pick up various kind of like consulting things here and there. And I would always just kind of have an eye on what else, what people were looking for, what they needed. And, Dr. Andy Galpin, one of the founders of Rapid, and now one of my two bosses, he posted on his Instagram, "Hey, we're looking for somebody with this expertise to do some coaching and consulting for us." And so I hit him up, and Andy and I had known each other 15 years or so. We had gone to grad school at the same time. I was at the University of Maryland when he was at Ball State. And, we had a lot of parallels in the ways that we would think about physiology. He's a muscle physiologist. I'm a vascular physiologist. So we didn't do work on the same kinds of things, but like our approach to physiology in general was similar. And I always liked his work, and he had done super well with one thing Andy's done extremely well is communicate science on social media and to the general public, to the masses, in a very effective way as somebody that's working in the academic space, which is, that's a rare and difficult thing to do. And so anyway, it's like, "Oh, Andy's looking for somebody. Let me talk to him." And so I got on with Rapid. This was early last year, started doing some consulting work for them, and it's similar, but different role. In April, it was last fall, about a year ago now, that I started the transition to my current role, which is again, is the labs guy, the labs analyst, which my other boss, Dan Garner, that's his domain, his bread and butter. He was the original labs analyst. He still is the head of that, but he's doing less work with the clients in the day to day and doing more like the higher level business things. And so he was looking for somebody to step in and do that so that he could work on the business. And so I was like, "Yeah, hey, I would love to do that. I think I've got the right background for it with the, you know, with all the physiology and everything and the educational piece too." And so, yeah, it's been since February that I've been in the role, and the role is screening each client's blood work, urine, stool, and saliva for, we look at somewhere around 500 biomarkers for their biggest physiological constraints, and or another way we describe them is performance anchors. So a physiological system can only perform to the extent that it's constrained. And so rather than try to make somebody, you know, a super high charged athlete with like crazy supplementation, which supplementation has a role for sure. But the approach that we take is like, all right, what is holding this person back from living up to their true physiological potential, as we call it. And I do that from the hidden side of things, that's all the biomarker work. So for a lot of folks, it's something to do with gut health. For it may be the inflammatory story, which those two tend to go hand in hand for sure. It's different for each person. Micronutrient status is a big thing. Lipid profile, you name it. Toxic burden, whatever it is. So we do quite an array of testing to get as complete a picture for each client as we can.
When it comes to gut biome, that's one that I haven't found the perfect supplement yet to really make. I'd actually say there was one I had, what was it called? Body Health have one called Gut Restore that I found actually worked quite well. But what do you normally suggest? You know, when, and obviously I'd say it's out of whack is not a very technical term. But what's wrong with, you know, which gut bacteria and which one is dominant? But as a general rule, what are some of the pre-probiotics that you would suggest or use to get someone's gut health to move towards normal again?
Well, first and foremost, we take a food forward approach, meaning, yes, there will be supplements to answer your question, but the biggest lever to pull when it comes to gut health is just eat more fiber. And that's what the beneficial bacteria in the gut actually need and use to do a process called fermentation, where they, when they ferment, they produce something called butyrate, and among other things, but the butyrate producing bacteria, they need the fiber to do that. And it's that butyrate turns out to be the major fuel source for the colonocytes, the cells that line the inner wall of our intestine. And when gut health is, there's a dysbiosis, which is a fancy word for when there's an imbalance in the gut microbiome, there's either too few or too little activity of the good guys, of the commensal bacteria, and an overabundance of the bad guys, the potentially pathogenic and opportunistic bacteria. When that happens, then there's essentially a lack of fuel availability for the cells that line the inner wall, and lack of fuel availability, just like in any other cell of the body, is a distress, a state of cellular distress. And that's one of the root causes of inflammation in the gut. And turns out that 70% of the immune cells in the body are housed in the GI tract, which is a wild statistic. Some studies suggest up to 80%. And so, going back to answer your question, what's the best way to like move the needle on all these things? Again, eat more fibers. You know, the target for men is somewhere in the ballpark of 30 to 35 grams of fiber per day. I think the average intake is under 10. So that's a big lever to pull right there. We can go a long way to restoring microbial balance and addressing GI symptoms just by that. You know, leafy green vegetables, it varies colors of all the vegetables. And, you know, maybe a fiber supplement to start if getting that target is difficult. Just from food sources. But then there's other supplements that help quite a bit. Glutamine is a go-to, and that is something that will support the mucosal lining of the gut. So the integrity of the gut barrier is the glutamine is a big part of that, and that can be calming and soothing. And then the rest of it depends on what other findings we might have besides like a dysregulated gut microbiome or any kind of GI health issues. There's certain targeted supplements that kind of go along with different issues. So for example, if somebody has got elevations in blood glucose, which tend to cluster with a distressed GI system, and especially with dysbiosis, then a product called berberine is a go-to that's got antimicrobial effects and some insulin sensitizing effects, can help help with blood glucose regulation and homeostatic control. So that's just a couple of supplements. There's others, but yeah.
You mentioned also, I think you say toxic load. Is that the term you used?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So People listening, we are absolutely dripping in all things carcinogenic. So what are the analyses that you do on those, and what are some of the effective methods of removing, you know, the metals and some of these, you know, horrendous things that we find ourselves exposed to?
Sure. The ones that pop up the most on the screens that we do are, before I get into it, I should say that these are the ones where the evidence isn't quite as strong, in the sense that there's not like really clear diagnostic criteria, and the science on these is good enough for us to include in our analyses, but we're not as confident as maybe like some of the blood markers that are really cut and dry and clear. So there's that caveat. But that being said, see a lot of folks flagging for elevations in metabolites of MTBE, which is basically an organic compound that is found in gasoline and is an environmental pollutant, basically. And the other would be metabolites of styrene, which comes from plastics. And these can be problematic for multiple reasons, but they just, if nothing else, they put strain and stress on our body's detoxification pathways, particularly liver detoxification. And that can deplete, that's a big drain on the glutathione system. Glutathione is really important for a lot of things in the body. Mitochondrial function is our most powerful antioxidant in the body, or among the most powerful. And so that can lead to other problems when present, which they often are, like, again, dealing with inflammation and cardiovascular support and so forth. So whenever what we do with my approach to dealing with toxic load is not, well, if it's styrene, then that's an easy one. Most of the time people are heating up their food in plastics. And so we just switch everything to glass, need to make a big deal about it, but you know, highly recommend using glass storage for food containers. And if you're going to reheat food in the microwave, do it in glass, not plastic. And then two, with the organic solvent stuff, I mean, that could be something as simple as you pump gas on your way to the clinic when you got your blood draw done. So it's, or if you live in an urban environment, or if occupationally, if you're out, you know, spending a lot of time in a police car or in a fire truck or in a fire station, it's going to be difficult to avoid the exposure. But what we can do is shore up our body's defenses against that. So we supplement with either glutathione directly. There's certain products out there that do a good job with that. But a better approach a lot of times is a product called N-acetylcysteine. It's a precursor to glutathione. It gets converted to glutathione in the body very readily, very effectively. And so we just kind of run people through, usually it's about a month or so of supplementation to specifically promote excretion through those pathways.
There's obviously a spectrum of target audiences when it comes to this technology. I think it's very exciting. I was talking to Josh Clemente from Levels about the autonomy that this blood work and apps and coaching can give an individual, so they're not finding out how they're doing every year when they go to a doctor, that they can have this ongoing ownership of their own health. What are the kind of groups that you're kind of helping with this? You've got obviously the billionaires and the bespoke ones that they have, I know Levels is all the way down to like $40 a month, for example. What is that group that you guys are helping?
Historically, it's been that very high net worth. It began, as I understand it, is before I was with the company, but primarily with elite athletes that Dan and Andy would be working with. And they just started scaling up that service from the elite, the UFC fighters, NFL, Major League Baseball, golfers. They started scaling that up, but not to athletes, but to like executive people of similar, financial means, honestly. And then most of the clientele in the company is still kind of that group. There are different tiers where it's not necessarily the ultra, ultra expensive, but still quite expensive packages. But the newest one that if you don't mind it, I'll mention is something called, we're calling Optima Muscle. And I have to say, I'm personally not all that involved in this program, but I can speak to it a little bit. It's essentially the thesis of it is the essence of the idea of the offering is that having muscle on your frame, the extent to which you do or do not, is a major determinant of longevity and not just longevity, but like quality of life, and also the susceptibility or lack thereof to disease. So everything we've been talking about is having more muscle mass is. And functional muscle mass as well is turns out to be highly anti-inflammatory. If inflammation is a concern, it's great for function. It's great for quality of life and the ability to do things like play, like we were talking about before. And so the way it works is clients will get an MRI scan, actually working with a company called Springbok. And this MRI scan assesses, I don't think it's quite every single muscle in the body, but near as much as every single muscle in the body, and looks at size of that muscle, of each muscle relative to population norms for myself, middle-aged 40-something-year-old average white guy, how do I stack up in that group? And then also one of the cool things it looks at is relative imbalances and asymmetries. And then so clients will be given and have the opportunity to work with a coach, I think if they want to, on an individualized training plan to address whatever that analysis is. And I don't know, I'm not here to necessarily totally promote it, I'm making people aware of it, but to the point, I don't know pricing structure, I don't know any of that kind of stuff. But I would say the folks who are interested in that, I would just do a Google search for rapidhealthoptimization.com. And that program's due to be launched here in the next few weeks. That information will be on that website in the near future. So
I know you've worked with elite athletes and also, as you mentioned, a lot of people in the corporate space. You mm-hmm. hear the phrase, you know, that the wealthy spent the first half of their life accruing wealth and then the second half spending it trying to get their health back. What is your perspective on that?
Oh, definitely have seen that. Definitely have seen that. I also see, I'm encouraged by the number of clients that we see who are obviously very wealthy, very successful in their, whatever their line of work is. You know, we've got a lot of investors and real estate folks and C-suite types and entrepreneurs. There's a large swath of these individuals who are also, they're high achievers in every area of their lives and come to a program like ours because they're already pretty dialed in fitness and nutrition. They're just looking to pull all the levers they can. They want to leave nothing unturned and they've got the means to do that. So I'm super encouraged to see that because what you just shared, James, is like the typical, scenario where, you know, they go all in and neglect their health just to the, and their family and everything else for the relentless pursuit of whether it's wealth or just, you know, work, being a workaholic. That's certainly still there. Absolutely. And we do have some of that, but I'm encouraged by this. That is an encouraging shift that I'm seeing, at least at this level. A lot of folks who are, maybe they've had that in the past, but by the time they're coming to us, they're like, okay, yeah, I'm actually already pretty well optimized. Let me just optimize even further. So, but, and just to finish the answer to that though, I could speak, I mentioned being overweight as a child. I would say I had a brief 6-year period, when I was in, first was my PhD and then my postdoc, where I would say that I did exactly what you just shared. I didn't get wealthy. Don't get me wrong, but I went all in on my education and became a complete, just very, very like obsessed workaholic and to the detriment of my health. And so it was the next, I'm still on the, now that was 12, 13 years ago that I turned the corner on that. But from ages roughly 27 or 28 to, no, that's not right. 24, 25 to like my early 30s. I was what I would refer to as an exercise philosopher. I would study exercise quite a bit, thought about it, wrote a hell of a lot about it, published quite a bit on it, but didn't do it as much as I did the bare minimum for sure. And so that was the other phase of my life where I actually struggled with weight and body composition. It was a very unhealthy assistant professor when I first started that job. So yeah, not the way to do things.
No, absolutely not. And I think it's, again, understanding the ultimate currency. And in my profession, I talk about this a lot. The ultimate currency is time with your family. And if you want to extrapolate even more, the ability to play with, you know, with your spouse, with absolutely. Your children, et cetera. Yeah. So that overtime, those the crazy work weeks, you know, they're not worth it. They're never, ever worth it. What's exciting is I hear, and again, you know, we're choosing from a much smaller section of society now that are able to be soldiers, you know, firefighters, cops. But I'm hearing over and over again that the fit candidates of those professions are in incredible shape. And not just, as we said, squeezing out performance, but they understand mobility and mindfulness and breath work and ice baths. So we have a lot of information. We have a great environment. So how do we push the walls back and start capturing that 70% and make it 60% and make it 50% where now all the areas, whether it's, you know, what we've discussed today, the CrossFit community, the Spartans and Tough Mudders and, you know, all these other kind of movements that have really forged community and wellness and health and strength and endurance and now kind of push that out to the rest of society.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the benefits of the fitness. You mentioned like CrossFit and some of those things. That's the training methodology that I follow for the most part. I'm a member of a CrossFit gym. Work out with a couple of, shout out to my buddies Logan and Zarb. They're police officers with the Georgia State Patrol, and I work with at least a couple firefighters as well. Dakota, if you listen to this, I'll send this to them later on. I think they'll appreciate it. But I talk about what you just shared with them quite a bit is, well, I actually asked the police officers, I said, so are the other guys and ladies in your cohort? Are they like you? Are they, you know, they into fitness? They're like, oh, not really. No. And so I don't know necessarily where I was going with that, but it's just, it's, I think I can speak just from seeing those guys and how they, how it impacts them and their profession. And I think I've never talked to them about it in great depth, but I'm sure that it's helpful for their mental health to be part of a fitness community 100%. And have that be an outlet. So a lot of times they'll come in after it's the only time I'll beat those guys in a workout, cause they're both fitter than me, is if they're coming in after like a 12-hour shift and they're just doing it real quick before they go home and go to bed, you know? Yeah, it's a good outlet, I think, coming off like a hard shift or just dealing with it, taking all the things that challenge your mental health and physical health and all your resilience, taking that in stride, just to shore up your own fitness is a big deal. It's a big deal. That's some anecdotal evidence, but that's something I've seen for sure.
100%. So. I did CrossFit since 2006 till about 2 years ago, 18 months ago, we shifted to Wolf Brigade programming. So it's more focused on, they've got maces and heavy kettlebells. And sure. So our coach now is Colombian and he's an absolute phenom, Esteban. He wins, you know, he's one of the best in the world. Cool. So he's kind of very slowly cool. Pushing some CrossFit stuff back in.
Okay.
But it was interesting because when I came off shift, I used to have the mentality of I'm just going to sweat off the stress, you know, 24 hours, 48 hours without sleep. And what I learned, and Jeff Nichols actually was someone who helped me kind of have this realization, is that there's a time and place. And if you're doing some complex WOD with snatches, maybe sleep deprivation isn't the time to do it. Because
probably not the right time to do that.
No, nope. You're just going to get more frustrated and more stressed. So
that's right.
When to 100% kind of dial it down.
Yeah. Oh, that's it. So 2006, man, you're an OG. I started in 2015. So this is coming up on 11 years. It's kind of like the base of my, I think of the base of my fitness, but I also do a lot of other things. I'm also a big runner. Mountain biking, CrossFit, I would say helped me get back into, it facilitated getting back into mountain biking after several years off. Cause I had the fitness there. But then it was, the thing with mountain biking is now I'm older and I'm less fearful, a lot more cautious when I'm out on the trail and, you know, not so reckless as I was when I was like 18, 19 years old. I don't need to fall down the side of a mountain or hit a tree or something like that. But anyway, yeah, it's good stuff.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I want to throw a quick closing questions out before I let you go. I know we're mindful of your headphones not running out of battery, so I'll keep it quick.
Yeah, hopefully they're okay. Yeah.
All right. The first one, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
Yeah, I got one right here. Outlive by Peter Thiel. If your audience hasn't read this one, it's a good one. It's, I really respect a lot of what pretty much everything that Peter Thiel believes and has to say about a lot of things we've been talking about, like longevity. So that would be definitely one that I recommend for sure.
What about films, documentaries, television shows?
Oh gosh, you're asking the wrong guy about any of that.
Game really of Thrones isn't going to be your answer.
No, I don't really watch TV. I like movies, but I don't really watch them. I watch a lot of YouTube, but that's my brain off time. That's cooking content. So let me put it this way. If that can be an outlet, this is how it's an outlet for me, is like kind of a creative outlet and a somewhat mentally stimulating. I'm not a big fan of just complete regularly scheduled, complete veg time. I'm just not, and that might be me. You might find some experts that disagree with me on that, but, the veg time for me is still somewhat stimulating, but like a different part of my brain and a hobby for me. That would be a whole other podcast that we could talk about cooking and like grilling meats and all that kind of stuff. That's my big thing. So that's my downside. So if film, television, YouTube, whatever it is, can check that box for you, then I would recommend it.
One of the people I'd love to get on, and it goes back to what we serve in schools, is Jamie Oliver, because did that in England.
I thought about him as you were asking me about schools. That's his big contribution to, I think that's his biggest professional contribution, what he did what he tried to do and what he, I think he was successful to a large degree, was he not?
I believe so. Yeah, it's hard as when you Google it to see, are they still doing it? The internet doesn't quite understand that. So yeah, I hope so.
Yep.
All right. Well, the next question, is there a person you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military and associated professions of the world?
If you can get him, my boss, Dan Garner, would be an incredible guest. And I recommend that to him too. I'll let him confirm this, but I believe he has experience with pretty much every type of individual. And if he hasn't worked directly with a lot of first responders, he will have a lot of insights into optimizing, you know, how to optimize your health within the constraints of like being on a difficult sleep schedule and, you know, shift work and all that kind of stuff. He will have some valuable experience to share for sure. So
brilliant. No, I'd love to get him on if that was something we could make happen. I had Andy on. It has to have been 6+ years ago now. So I probably need to get him back on too.
You could get him back as well. That'd be the equally enthusiastic recommendation as well.
Brilliant. All right. Well, the last question before we make sure everyone knows where to find Rapid and yourself online. Mm-hmm. What do you do to decompress?
I just shared the biggest one. I would say on a personal level is I cook. I love cooking and eating. That's a big part of like the thing that makes me really excited is making it all work in the sense of like, I don't want to ever, I'm big on nutrition and body composition and fitness, but I also in equal measure love food. And so like having those two gel is challenging, is difficult, but I feel like I've got a really good handle on it. So I get really excited about that. And so, I do that. The other thing, even more than that though, that I do to decompress, even though it's also a big effort. It's cliche, man, but playing with my little boy, can't beat it. It's the highlight of my life, the thing I look forward to the most every single day. So it's decompression. At the same time, it's tiring, but it's the best thing in the world. So
it's not cliche at all. And I think that's the problem is that we almost frame it that way rather than realizing that is the most important thing.
And it's the reason for everything else, right?
Absolutely. Quick question about the cooking. Is that something you got into more recently or have you always been into it?
Oh no, lifelong. I started cooking for myself in college. It was a complete disaster. But just always enjoyed it. Always loved it. And yeah, experimented with different things. Lately I've been trying to master seafood, which is difficult. It's a hard thing to do to cook a piece of fish. They're very delicate. But getting there. We're getting there.
I cook, but I don't have a very wide repertoire, and that's what I'm trying to do is learn new recipes. But I think I've heard, you know, many people allude to this. When you cook, I mean, obviously, firstly, there's the part where you just understand where food originally comes from, learning about meats and the vegetables and things, which I think we underestimate how few people actually know that. You know, again, if we're not educating in schools or not serving real food, but also preparing the body to eat. If you are going through a cooking process, there's things that are happening in our physiology that are preparing us to receive that food. If you drive through into a McDonald's and then 20 seconds later you're ramming a Big Mac down your throat, then you know you're shocking the body basically.
It is interesting. I haven't seen a lot of that, but I completely that seems like that makes a lot of sense for sure. You're just as with anything, most things in physiology, there's like a priming component, you know, and that makes sense that preparing food would have a physiological effect.
Absolutely.
I have to look into that. That's interesting stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, if you think about even just salivation, when you smell it, there's things you can observe within yourself. Okay. I'm getting ready. All right. Well, for people listening, where are the best places online to find Rapid? And then what about yourself if they want to follow you or reach out?
So Rapid would be just rapidhealthoptimization.com. Their Instagram, I'm going to type it in to my laptop here to make sure that I get it right. It's a difficult one, and maybe I can send it to you and we can paste it into show notes or whatever, but it's called Arete Performance Lab. That's on Instagram. A-R-E-T-E Performance Lab. That's, and all of that is all one all one word. That is, and can you still hear me, James?
You're still good.
Okay. I got one left. Maybe you can hang on. That's their Instagram, but their rapidhealthoptimization.com is the also a good place. And then for me personally, I am Dr. Nathan Jenkins on Instagram. And that's pretty much my only social media presence. So yeah, lots of fitness stuff, food things, and goofy videos of me and my son playing. So
brilliant. Well, I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast. It's been an amazing conversation, very unique perspective between, as you mentioned, the very academic lab focused lens that you had, and then now what you're doing with these biomarkers and helping these high performers. So thank you again for coming on the Behind the Shield podcast.
Happy to do it. Really enjoyed it. And I hope this was valuable for your audience. I really enjoyed it.